own writings, Mord and Brown had a secret agenda. From the beginning, neither man had any intention of looking for a lost city. The only entry in the journal mentioning the lost city is a random note jotted on a back page almost as an afterthought, clearly a reference to Konzamius. It reads in its entirety, White City, 1898, Paulea, Plantain, Wampu, heads of these streams should be near location of city. Timoteo, Rosales, one-eyed rubber cutter, crossing from Paulea to Plantain, saw columns still standing in 1905. In hundreds of pages of entries, this is the entire sum of information touching on the lost city they were supposedly trying to find. The city they had described so vividly to the American media. They were not looking for archaeological sites. They made only cursory inquiries. The journals reveal they found in Moskisha no ruins, no artifacts, no sites, no lost city of the monkey god. So what were Mord and Brown doing in Moskisha during those 4 months of silence while Hay and the world held their breath? What were they after? Gold. Their search for gold was not a spur-of-the-moment decision. Among their hundreds of pounds of gear, Mord and Brown had packed sophisticated gold mining equipment, including gold pans, shovels, picks, equipment for building sluice boxes, and mercury for amalgamation. Note that Mord, who could have chosen any partner for his expedition, selected a geologist, not an archaeologist. Brown and Mord went into the jungle with detailed information on possible gold deposits along the creeks and tributaries of the Rio Blanco and planned their route accordingly. This area was long rumored to be rich in placer gold deposited in gravel bars and holes along stream beds. The Rio Blanco is many miles south of where they claim to have found the lost city. When I mapped the journal entries day by day, I found that Brown and Mord never went up the Paulea or Platano rivers. While going up the Patuca, they bypassed the mouth of the Wampu and continued far south to where the Rio Cuyamel joins the Patuca, and then went up that to the Rio Blanco. They never came within 40 miles of that area encompassing the headwaters of the Paulea, Platano, and Wampu rivers, which was the general region in which they later claimed to have found the lost city of the monkey god. They were looking for another California, another Yukon. Everywhere they went, they dug into gravel bars and panned for color, bits of gold, totting up in fanatical detail each fleck they spied. Finally, at a creek running into the Blanco River called Ulacuaz, they did indeed strike gold. An American named Peril or Pearl, all this is noted in the journal, had set up a gold sluicing operation here in 1907. But Pearl, the wastrel son of a wealthy New Yorker, frittered away his time drinking and whoring instead of mining, and his father shut him down. The operation was abandoned in 1908. He left a dam, water pipes, gate valves, an anvil, and other useful equipment behind, which Mord and Brown fixed up and reused. At the mouth of Ulacuaz, Mord and Brown dismissed all their Indian guides and went up the creek, setting up Camp Ulac in the same place Pearl had worked. Then they spent the next 3 weeks, the heart of their expedition, in the backbreaking daily work of mining gold. They repaired Pearl's old dam to divert the creek into sluice boxes, where the flow of water over riffles and burlap was used to separate and concentrate the heavier gold particles from gravel, and recorded their daily take in the journal. They worked like dogs, drenched by downpours, eaten alive by swarms of sandflies and mosquitoes, picking 30 to 50 ticks a day off their bodies. They were in perpetual terror of poisonous snakes, which were ubiquitous. They ran out of coffee and tobacco and began to starve. They spent most of their free time playing cards. "We thrash out our gold prospects again and again," Mord wrote, "and ponder the probable progress of the war, wondering if America has already become involved." They also dreamed big. "We've located a fine spot for an airport," Brown wrote, "just across the river. We will probably build our permanent camp on this same plateau if our plans go through." But the rainy season fell upon them with a fury. Torrential downpours that started as a roar in the treetops, dumping inches on them daily. Ulakwas Creek swelled with every new downpour, and they struggled to manage the rising water. On June 12th, disaster struck. A massive cloudburst triggered a flash flood, which tore down the creek, bursting their dam and carrying off their gold mining operation. "Obviously, we no longer can work gold," Mord lamented in the journal. "Our dam is completely gone. So are our planks. The best course of events, we feel, is to wind up our affairs here as hastily as possible and head down the river again." They abandoned their mine, loaded the pit pan with their supplies and gold, and set off down the swollen rivers at breakneck speed. They careened down the Ulakwas to the Blanco, to the Cuyamel, and into the Patuca. In one day, they covered a stretch of the Patuca that had taken them 2 weeks to motor up. When they finally reached the edge of civilization, in a settlement along the Patuca where the residents had a radio, Mord heard about the fall of France. He was told that America was practically in the war and would be officially in a day or so. They panicked at the thought of being marooned in Honduras. "We decided to haste completion of the entire expedition's aims." What they meant by this enigmatic sentence is debatable, but it appears they might have realized they had to get busy fabricating a cover story and get their hands on some ancient artifacts, allegedly from the lost city, to bring back to Hay. There is no mention in the journals up to this point of finding or carrying any artifacts out of the Mesquite interior. They continued on, ripping down the swollen Patuca by day and sometimes at night. On June 25th, they reached Brewer's Lagoon, now Bruce Laguna and the sea. They spent a week there, no longer in a rush, as they had learned America was far from joining the war. On July 10th, they finally arrived in the capital city, Tegucigalpa. At some point between these two dates, Mord wrote the fabricated report to his patron, George Hay, which generated the New York Times article. On their return to New York, Mord told the story of their discovery of the lost city of the Monkey God again and again, and each time it got more detailed. The public loved it. Their rather modest collection of artifacts was put on display at the museum, along with a pit pan or dugout canoe. The journals indicate that the two men hastily acquired these artifacts after they left the jungle, in a place west of Brewer's Lagoon near the coast. A Spaniard showed them a site with pottery scattered about, where they did some digging. It seems likely they also purchased artifacts from locals at the same time. But the journal is silent on that question. Mord and Brown made no effort in the journals to conceal or dissemble their actions. Why they wrote down such a frank record of deception is hard to understand. Clearly, they had no intention of ever sharing the contents of these journals with their patron, Hay, or the public. Perhaps they were filled with hubris and dreamed that a fabulous gold strike would be part of their legacy, and they wanted to record it for posterity. Their announcement of the lost city discovery might have been a last-minute impulse, but it seems more likely it was planned all along as a cover for their real agenda. We do know this. For decades, many have wondered if Mord found a city. The general consensus up until now has been that he probably did find an archaeological site, perhaps even an important one. The journals, however, are proof that Mord found nothing, and his discovery was an out-and-out fraud. But what about the walking stick and its enigmatic directions? I recently corresponded with Derek Parent, who had spent decades exploring La Mosquitia, studying Mord's root, and trying to decipher the stick. He probably knows more about Mord than anyone alive, and he had been in close contact with Mord's family for decades. Over the years, David Mord had sent Parent photocopies of various bits of the journals, a few pages at a time. At one point in our correspondence, Parent told me that Mord's discovery of the city was in the missing parts of the journals. "What missing parts?" I asked. That was when David Mord's apparent ploy unraveled. David Mord had claimed to Parent that most of Journal 2 was missing. All that remained, he said, was the journal's first page, which he photocopied and sent to Parent. The rest of Journal 2 was gone, and he said he felt sure that the missing section was the part that recorded Mord's journey up the Paulea River to the city of the Monkey God. And why was that part missing? Mord explained to Parent that British military intelligence had ordered the family to burn Mord's papers after his death, and it might have been lost that way. Or it may have been destroyed during a period when the journals were being stored in a damp warehouse in Massachusetts that was infested with rats. I was surprised when Parent told me this, because those pages David Mord claimed were gone are not missing from the original journal at all. I had the entirety of Journal 2, every single numbered page, firmly bound into the hardcover book, with no gaps in dates or missing text. The allegedly lost part of Journal 2 records nothing more than the time Mord spent relaxing in Brewer's Lagoon, getting chummy with local expats, sailing and fishing, and taking a day trip to dig for artifacts. Why the deception? One might speculate that David Mord may have been protecting the memory of his uncle or the honor of his family, but unfortunately, he is unavailable to explain. He is serving a prison term for a serious crime. After his incarceration, his wife, perhaps unwittingly, sent the complete journals to the National Geographic Society. When I shared these findings with Derek Parent and sent him a copy of the rest of Journal 2, he emailed me back, "I'm in utter shock." Despite the skullduggery, the mystery of the walking stick persists. In the wake of this news, Parent told me his latest theories. He thinks the stick may have recorded directions from Camp Ulloch or its environs to some locale of interest. Mord, he believes, found something and carved the directions to it on his walking stick instead of putting them in his journal. Something so important, he wanted to keep it even more secret than the journal he was sharing with Brown. Parent took the directions from the walking stick and mapped them. The compass bearings and distances, he says, correspond with the twists and turns of the Rio Blanco going upstream from the mouth of Ulakwaz Creek. He believes the stick logged a journey recording steps along the riverbank to a now well-defined endpoint. That endpoint, Parent identified, was a narrow, 300-acre valley through which the Rio Blanco flowed. This valley has never been investigated. It might have been another promising deposit of placer gold, which Mord hoped to return to later, perhaps without Brown, or it might have marked some other discovery of interest. The mystery of the walking stick remains unsolved. We now know, however, that it does not contain coded directions to the lost city. In a journal entry on June 17, 1940, on the very last day of the expedition, before his reemergence from the wilderness and arrival in a civilized town, Mord wrote, "We are convinced no great civilization ever existed up there, and there are no archaeological discoveries of importance to be made." Chapter 6. We took canoes into the heart of darkness. For three quarters of a century, Mord's tall tale, so rich in romance and adventure, had given impetus to the fable of the lost city. The White City, or Monkey God legend, became a part of the Honduran national psyche, a tale familiar even to school children. In 1960, the Honduran government drew a line around 2,000 square miles of the largely unexplored interior of Mosquitia and called it the Ciudad Blanca Archaeological Reserve. In 1980, UNESCO named the area the Rio Platano Biosphere Reserve, and 2 years later declared this unique rainforest a World Heritage Site. Meanwhile, ambitious explorers continued to make dubious and unverified claims of having found the lost city, while many archaeologists suspected a city of that nature might exist in some form deep in the jungle, either near Mord's claimed area or somewhere else. In 1994, the chief of archaeology for the Honduran government, George Hassaman, said in an interview that he believed all the large sites in Mosquitia may have been part of a single political system whose center, the White City, had not yet been found. Steve Elkins first heard of the White City from an adventurer named Steve Morgan, who was a professional collector of legends and stories. Morgan had compiled a list of what he considered to be the world's greatest unsolved mysteries, and he had boxes of files of research into various lost cities, pirate treasures, ancient tombs, and shipwrecks loaded with gold. Morgan engaged in marine salvage for a living and had actually found a number of shipwrecks. His house was full of stacks of Chinese porcelain and chests heaped with silver Spanish reels and pieces of eight. Elkins, who owned a business in L.A. renting camera equipment to television production crews, decided he wanted to go into television production himself since he had the gear. He consulted Morgan and pored over his list of unsolved mysteries with fascination. Two mysteries attracted Elkins' special attention: the legend of Ciudad Blanca and the Lutes of Lima, also known as the Cocos Island Treasure. Elkins and Morgan teamed up, did some research into Ciudad Blanca, and identified an area in Mosquitia they thought might contain it. They organized an expedition led by Morgan. Elkins sold the idea of a television show about the search to Spiegel TV in Germany. Elkins, his German co-producer and correspondent, along with his California film crew, arrived in Honduras in 1994. They hired a local fixer, a man named Bruce Heineke, to handle logistics. A childhood friend of Morgan's, Heineke was an American married to a Honduran. He had been doing business in Honduras for many years as a gold prospector, drug smuggler, treasure hunter, and archaeological looter. While the choice of a man like Heineke might have seemed eccentric, the expedition required someone who not only knew his way around Honduras, but also had a keen understanding of when and how to bribe people, a delicate art, how to manage Honduran bureaucracy, how to intimidate and threaten, and how to deal with dangerous criminals without getting killed. Elkins recalled seeing Heineke for the first time in the airport parking lot after their arrival. He was a big, fat guy dressed in a pineapple shirt, pinky ring, and gold watch, cigarette dangling from his mouth with a wad of bills in his fist. He was barking orders in Spanish and passing out money. "We got a video of him," said Elkins. "It's hilarious." It would be the beginning of a long and complicated relationship. The crew filmed in Copan and then took a bush flight to a little town called Palacios on the Mosquito Coast. From there, they set off into the interior with indigenous guides and a rough idea of where the lost city might be based on their research and interviews. "We took canoes into the heart of darkness," Elkins remembered. Morgan led the expedition, hiring local informants who claimed to know of an area deep in the mountains where there were ruins. "To be honest," Elkins said, "I just tagged along. I really didn't know where the fuck we were going." The canoes were 40-foot dugouts, hollowed out of a single mahogany tree trunk, equipped with small outboard Evinrudes. Each could fit 6 people and a bunch of gear. "We went up some little river. I don't even know the name of it. Upstream, the water became so shallow and full of sunken logs and mud bars that they had to raise the engines and propel themselves along by poling. They went miles and miles through endless swamps and up unknown tributaries, following wavering, uncertain maps. We were constantly in and out of the canoes, in the muck. It got denser and denser and denser until we were up high in the mountains. There was no sign of any lost cities, but they did make a discovery. All of a sudden there was this big boulder in a stream, Elkin said, with a carving on it, showing a guy with a fancy headdress planting seeds. He had what he called an epiphany. Here was proof, if more were needed, that a sophisticated and mysterious people had once lived and farmed in a land that today was deep, uninhabited jungle. Led by local Indian guides, Elkins and the group pushed on, forced to abandon their canoes and continue on foot, slashing their way through the jungle with machetes. On a hard day's travel, they were lucky to make 1 or 2 miles. Steve and his crew ate MREs, while the Indian guides ate iguanas. At one point, the guides became agitated. Taking out their weapons, they confided that the group was being tracked by jaguars. They frequently ran into venomous snakes and were assaulted day and night by insects. "After I came out," Elkins recalled, "I had bites for 6 months." He was grateful not to have been stricken with one of the many frightful tropical diseases common to the area. One night, he exited his tent to go to the bathroom. The entire forest was glowing with millions of points of bioluminescence caused by fungi that glow when the temperature and humidity are right. It was like looking down at L.A. from 30,000 feet, he said. "The most beautiful thing I've ever seen." Somewhere in the rainforest, they did find a scattering of broken stone sculptures, pottery, and tools. If there were mounds, it was impossible to tell, because the jungle was so thick. But either way, it was a small site and clearly not the White City. They finally gave up, exhausted and out of money. Elkins was repeatedly shocked at Heinicke's methods of getting things done in Honduras. After they reemerged from the jungle and were filming on Roatan Island in the Bay of Honduras, Elkin's lead German producer got an emergency call on his satellite phone requiring his return to Hamburg immediately on business. They rushed to the airport to catch a flight out, but when they arrived, they learned the plane was already full and on the runway. The next flight out wasn't for several days. Heinicke huffed and puffed his way out on the tarmac, boarded the plane, pulled out a Colt 45 pistol and inquired who was the last to board. He waved his pistol at the unfortunate passenger. "I need your fucking seat," he said. "Get off." The man stumbled off the plane in terror. Heinicke shoved the gun back into his waistband and said to the German producer, "Okay, you got your seat." Many years later, when Heinicke told me this story, he explained how he saw his role in the partnership. "See, Steve, he's kind of dangerous to be with. He'll tell me the good points he sees in someone, and I'll say, 'Fuck him. I don't like him. I don't trust him.' That's probably why we make a good partnership." Elkins, for his part, said, "Bruce is definitely the kind of guy you want to have on your side, and not the other way around." He added, lowering his voice, "In order to make this happen, I had to dance with the devil at times." That first attempt to find the White City changed Elkins. He went in curious about the White City legend and returned having found his life's mission. "I call it the Lost City Virus," he told me later. "I became an addict. I was obsessed with the idea of trying to prove whether the Lost City really existed." Elkins had an appealing streak of persistence and an indefatigable nature, which may very well come from his unconventional family. Originally from England and Russia, his great-grandparents arrived in the States through Ellis Island in the 1890s. His grandfather, Jack Elkins, was a jazz piano player who toured with Dixieland bands in the 1920s. Elkins' father, Bud, went in an entirely different direction, into the army, He lied about his age to sign up at 15, but was caught during basic training, and his mother had to come get him and drag him back home to finish high school. During World War II, Bud flew against the Japanese in the Aleutian Tiger Squadron. After the war, he went into the garment business, landing a contract to manufacture bunny outfits for Playboy clubs. He then went back into the Army and took part in combat and intelligence-gathering missions in Vietnam, reaching the rank of colonel. His ultimate retirement dream was to own a Chicago-style kosher hot dog business. So after leaving the military, he built a giant truck in the shape of a hot dog and drove it around L.A. selling dogs and Polish sausages before the business failed. Bud was a charmer and a ladies' man, restless with a yearning for adventure. Because of his philandering, Steve's mother divorced him when Steve was 11, and Steve grew up more or less fatherless in Chicago. "My mother was the salt of the earth and steady as a rock," he said. Elkins seems to have inherited his father's wanderlust along with his mother's pragmatic steadfastness, a mixture of traits that would serve him well in the search for the lost city. Elkins attended Southern Illinois University. An avid hiker, he roamed the nearby Shawnee National Forest with friends who called him "Over the Next Ridge Elkins" because he was always urging them on to see what was over the next ridge. On one of these jaunts, he found a rock shelter on some bluffs overlooking the Mississippi River. He camped out there with friends, and they began scratching around in the dirt, turning up arrowheads, spear points, bones, and broken pottery. He brought them back to the university. His archaeology professor arranged an excavation of the cave as a special studies program for the semester. In test excavations, Elkins and the group uncovered human bones, carvings in shell, stone tools, and remains of food. Radiocarbon dating indicated the bottom layers were thousands of years old. "That was the moment I became hooked on ancient history," he told me. He spent many hours sitting in the shelter, looking out over the Mississippi River Valley and imagining what it would have been like to be born in the cave, grow up, raise children, get old, and die there, in the America of 5,000 years ago. Elkins' first expedition into Moskisha had impressed on him one brutally simple fact. Walking aimlessly through the jungle is crazy. This is no way to find anything. He needed to address the problem in a more systematic way. He accomplished this with a two-pronged attack: historical research and space-age technology. He delved deeply into the many stories of people who had looked for the White City, some of whom actually claimed to have found it. Most of these people were obvious cranks or otherwise untrustworthy, but there was one person who stood out. Steve Morgan had introduced Elkins to a man named Sam Glassmeyer, who said he had located and explored the White City. When Elkins met Glassmeyer, he found him to be a solid, respectable scientist with a surprisingly credible story. And in his living room were impressive stone sculptures he had allegedly carried out of the ruins. In 1997, Elkins and his video team interviewed Glassmeyer at his home in Santa Fe, and they captured his story on tape. "I first met Steve on this trip, as I lived in Santa Fe myself." In a twist on the Mord expedition, Glassmeyer, a geologist, had been hired to prospect for gold in Moskisha and went looking for the lost city instead. He led three prospecting expeditions into Moskisha in the late 1950s. A tough, weather-beaten man with a gravelly, slow-talking New Mexico drawl, Glassmeyer had built a career as a respected scientist who had worked as an engineer for Los Alamos National Laboratory in the mid-50s when Los Alamos was still a closed city. He grew disenchanted with making nuclear bombs, so he moved to Santa Fe and set up a geological consulting firm. In 1959, he had been hired by American mining interests to determine if there was placer gold along the gravel bars of the upper Patuca River and its tributaries. His employers had a lot of money. The budget for the first expedition alone was $40,000, and they would send Glassmeyer back twice more. On that first expedition, Glassmeyer heard many rumors of the White City. "You hear about it as soon as you get in Honduras," he recalled to Elkins. As he explored the rivers looking for gold, he pestered his guides with questions. "I frequently heard natives mention the mysterious Ciudad Blanca," he wrote in a 1960 article about his discovery in the Denver Post. "I asked my guide about it. He finally told me the men were afraid I planned to send the expedition up the Rio Guampu, toward Ciudad Blanca. If I did," he said, "the men would desert." When Glassmeyer asked why, the guide said that when the conquistadors arrived, Ciudad Blanca was a magnificent city. Then came an unforeseen series of catastrophes. The people decided the gods were angry, and so they abandoned the city, leaving all their belongings behind, and thereafter shunned it as a forbidden place. On his third prospecting expedition into Honduras, Glassmeyer found placer beds along the Rio Blanco and the Rio Cuyamel. "Gold beyond all my expectations, in approximately the same area where Mord had struck gold." But Glassmeyer couldn't get the lost city out of his mind. "When I got all through with my work," he told Elkins, "I went off looking for it." He selected 10 men, including an old Sumu, Mayana Indian, who said he had been to Ciudad Blanca as a boy and remembered where it was. "I had to bribe them pretty heavy with money to get them to go with me. We went far up a jungle river, what they call the Rio Guampu, and then went off on a tributary called the Pao. We were in dugout canoes all this time. We ran out of stream and we had to take off on foot." They slashed their way overland. "It's one of the most terrific jungles in the world," he recalled. "The area is very mountainous, very rough, and very steep. I don't know of any more remote place in the world." After 6 days of brutal overland travel, on March 10, 1960, he saw an unusual mound, like a giant ice cream cone, overturned and covered with greenery. In a small meadow, they came across artifacts strewn over the ground, including what appeared to be a ceremonial seat or throne, decorated with an animal's head. As they pushed forward, other mounds bulged out of the boundless jungle carpet. "I also discerned elusive ash-gray specks sprinkled throughout the shimmering greenness. My 9-power binoculars exposed them for what they were: ruins of stone buildings." "I found it," he cried out to his Indian guides. "I found Ciudad Blanca." They hacked their way through and around the city for 3 days, but he estimated that their movement through the jungle was so slow that the entire exploration of the city amounted to no more than a walk around the park. He brought out a collection of beautiful stone carvings and other artifacts, saying he had to leave tons behind. Glassmeyer tried to interest a foundation or a university in the discovery. The University of Pennsylvania expressed a desire to have his collection, he told Elkins, so he shipped off the majority of his artifacts, photographs, and maps, but still retaining many sculptured heads and stone bowls. His daughter, Bonnie, still has the collection, which I have seen. It contains stone vessels, metates, and stone heads of fine workmanship, including a fabulous carving of Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent, identical to the one in the Michael Rockefeller collection at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. The artifacts alone suggest he found a major site, and a photograph taken of a cache of objects at the ruins shows a tremendous collection of sculptures that he had to leave behind. His hand-drawn map delineates previously unknown details of streams in the upper watershed of the Pao River, proving he did indeed penetrate that unexplored region. According to Glassmeyer's interview, the university mounted an expedition, but instead of coming in from the sea and going up the rivers by canoe, it started in the town of Catacamas, and they tried to take a shortcut over the mountains. 3 or 4 of them were killed, he said, 2 by snakes, and the others by disease. The expedition had to turn back. I have been unable to confirm that this expedition ever took place, and the University of Pennsylvania insists they have no such collection. I also checked with Penn State in case he was confused. But Glassmeyer's daughter, Bonnie, is equally certain her father sent some of his materials to the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology. Glassmeyer gave a copy of his map to Steve Elkins. It was not quite detailed enough to nail down the precise location, but it was accurate enough for Elkins to later identify a valley that probably contained Glassmeyer's ruin. Elkins would name it Target 4 in his aerial survey as we were looking for the White City many years later. Glassmeyer's discovery was a major step forward. It gave Elkins a convincing report of at least one important unknown ruin deep in the Mosquitia interior. He took it as strong evidence that the legends of lost cities were not fantasy. The second prong of Elkins' attack on the problem involved bringing the latest space-age technology to the search. For this, Elkins turned to Ron Blom at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Elkins knew of Ron Blom's successful quest to find the lost city of Ubar in the Rub al-Khali Desert, the Empty Quarter, on the Arabian Peninsula. Ubar, also called Iram of the Pillars, had been mentioned in the Quran, which said, "The Lord poured upon them a scourge of punishment for corruption, smiting the city and driving it into the sands." By scrutinizing images of the Empty Quarter desert from space, Blom and his team discovered a radiating pattern of ancient caravan trails, not visible on the ground, that converged at what was already known to be an ancient watering hole and caravan sarai, a place where ancient camel caravans bedded down for the night. The satellite data indicated far more was there than a mere campsite. When the team excavated, they uncovered the shattered ruins of a fortress over 15 centuries old, with massive walls and 8 towers, matching the description in the Quran. They also figured out what had happened. The constant removal of water from the watering hole undermined the fortress, which one day collapsed into a sinkhole and was buried by drifting sands. The legend recorded in the Quran was based on a real event. Elkins called Blom and asked if he was interested in looking for another lost city. Blom said yes. The problem, however, was that Mosquitia offered a far greater challenge than the Arabian Desert. The desert is an open book. Synthetic aperture radar can peer 15 feet or more into dry desert sands. The key is dry. Water molecules strongly absorb radar. For this reason, jungle foliage is far more difficult to see through with radar. A big leaf will bounce back a radar beam that can penetrate several feet of dry sand. Undeterred by the challenge, Blom and his team started by analyzing scores of satellite images of Mosquitia taken in infrared and visual wavelengths of light. They looked at synthetic aperture radar images taken from the space shuttle. Blom combined images, crunched data, massaged and enhanced it. It took months of effort, but finally it seemed Blom hit the jackpot. He and his team identified an area that seemed to contain rectilinear and curvilinear shapes that were not natural. They termed both the valley and the unknown feature Target 1, or T1. On May 12, 1997, Elkins faxed one of his partners, Tom Weinberg, with the news. "This valley is completely surrounded by very steep mountains, with the exception of one small cut through the mountains that allows access. There are 2 small streams that flow through the valley. It is a perfect spot for a settlement. Kind of reminds me of the movie Shangri-La. Excitedly, he noted at the end of the facts that Blom had identified a rather large 1,800 feet, according to Ron's measurement, L-shaped object. The valley itself was striking, a mysterious geological formation that looked like a crater or bowl, walled in by steep encircling ridges, creating a natural fortress. It did indeed look very much like the descriptions of Shangri-La, or, even more apposite, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Lost World. The terrain inside the valley, watered by two rivers, was gentle and friendly, consisting of hills, terraces, and floodplains, well-suited for ancient farming and settlement. The satellite images showed no signs of human entry, occupation, or indigenous Indian use. It appeared to be pristine, untouched rainforest. Absolutely uninhabited areas of tropical rainforest are very rare in the world today. Even the remotest reaches of the Amazon, for example, or the highlands of New Guinea, are used seasonally by indigenous people and have been at least minimally explored by scientists. It was an exciting idea, but for now it was just an idea, a hypothesis. Even with intensive image processing, the immense 150-foot triple canopy rainforest did not yield its secrets. Most of the unclassified satellite imagery at the end of the 20th century had a coarse 90-foot ground resolution. In other words, the smallest thing that could be seen in the images was at least 90 feet on a side. The images showed blurred outlines that, if one stared at them long enough, looked unnatural. But it was far from definite proof. They were a bit like Rorschach blots. Perhaps the mind was seeing things that weren't there. Eager to learn more, Elkins wondered if the valley had ever been explored. He and his partner Tom Weinberg scoured the world for people who had spent time in Mosquitia and interviewed them on camera. He collected the stories of archaeologists, gold prospectors, drug smugglers, geologists, looters, and adventurers. He hired researchers who combed the archives in Honduras and elsewhere, piecing together which areas of Mosquitia had been explored and which had not. After much research, he determined that T1 was truly unexplored. Virtually all expeditions into Mosquitia had gone up the big rivers and their navigable tributaries. Rivers are the traditional highways of the jungle. Expeditions that departed from those rivers never got very far in the fierce, impassable mountains. But T1 had no navigable rivers, and it was completely walled off by mountains. In the end, it was a gut feeling Elkins had about T1. "I just thought that if I were a king, this would be the perfect place to hide my kingdom." Chapter 7. The Fish That Swallowed the Whale. Convinced he was on the verge of solving the mystery, Steve immediately began planning an expedition into T1. The logistics were a nightmare. The Honduran government bureaucracy that controlled the permits was erratic and dysfunctional. The factionalized political environment meant that if one politician agreed to help, the opposition blocked it. But with gentle persistence and cultivation of both sides, along with some well-placed funds, Elkins finally did get the permits to explore T1. During this entire time, he had carefully kept the location secret from the Honduran government, fearing the information might lead to possible looting. A high-level diplomatic balancing act. He successfully lined up six figures in financing. Hoping to avoid weeks of brutal overland travel, he planned to go in by helicopter. But all his plans came to an abrupt end on October 29, 1998, when Honduras was struck by Hurricane Mitch. Mitch dumped as much as 3 feet of rain in some areas, causing catastrophic floods and mudslides, leaving 7,000 dead, spreading disease and triggering looting and civil unrest. The storm inflicted damage equal to about 70% of Honduras's GDP, and it destroyed two-thirds of Honduras's roads and bridges. The expedition had to be canceled. There was little sense of when, if ever, it could be restarted. The president at the time said the storm had set back the Honduran economy by half a century. Many years of chaos and collapse followed, in which the murder rate soared while investment and the judicial system crumbled. One Honduran businessman told a reporter for The Telegraph in 2013, "This country is turning into the perfect zombie apocalypse." There are two major reasons why Honduras had such a difficult time getting back on its feet after the storm. The first was the land tenure system it inherited from Spain, in which a small number of extremely wealthy families ended up controlling most of the land. But even more debilitating was the country's unhealthy relationship with the United States, whose short-sighted policies and business interests had kept the country politically unstable for more than a century. From the time of its independence in 1821 to the present, Honduras has suffered through a tumultuous history that includes close to 300 civil wars, rebellions, coups, and unplanned changes in government. One might say that modern Honduran history began in 1873, when Jules Verne introduced Americans to the banana in his novel Around the World in 80 Days, where he praised it as being as healthy as bread and as succulent as cream. Originally from Asia, bananas had been grown in Central America for centuries since they had been brought there by the Spanish, but they were an exotic delicacy in the United States because of their scarcity and perishability. In 1885, Boston entrepreneur Andrew Preston and a partner formed the Boston Fruit Company, with the idea of using fast steamships rather than sail to get bananas to market before they spoiled. It was a success. Inexpensive, delicious bananas took the country by storm. By the turn of the century, Boston Fruit, which was later merged into the United Fruit Company, had carved out 40,000 acres of banana plantations along the northern coastline of Honduras, becoming the largest employer in the country. This was the beginning of a long and destructive relationship between American banana companies and the country of Honduras, earning it the pejorative nickname Banana Republic. United Fruit and the other fruit companies that soon followed became infamous for their political and tax machinations, engineered coups, bribery, and exploitation of workers. They strangled the country's evolution and cultivated a corrupt and extreme form of crony capitalism in which they subverted the government to their own ends. A central figure in this history was an American named Samuel Zamuray, a young Russian immigrant who started off as a pushcart peddler in Alabama. When he was 18, he noticed that the Boston Fruit cargo ships arriving in the port of Mobile were throwing away the bananas that had ripened during the voyage, because they would spoil before they could get to market. Zamuray bought a load of these ripe bananas for almost nothing, filled up a railroad car, and rolled it inland, telegraphing to grocers along the way to meet the boxcar and buy his cheap bananas quick. By the time he turned 21, he had made over $100,000, and had become known as Sam the Banana Man. Zamuray founded the Cuymel Fruit Company with two tramp steamers and 5,000 acres of banana groves on the Honduran coast. The American appetite for bananas was insatiable. And it still is. The banana is consistently the number one selling item in Walmart superstores. While the fruit companies were flourishing, the Honduran economy was in almost perpetual crisis. At this time, the British were still the bankers to the world, and they had unwisely loaned Honduras far more money than the country could repay. Honduran sovereign debt had grown so large that the British were threatening to go to war with Honduras to collect it. The possibility of the United Kingdom, or any European power, Interfering in Central America was unacceptable to U.S. President William Howard Taft. In 1910, his Secretary of State, Philander Knox, recruited J.P. Morgan in a scheme to buy Honduran debt from the British, which he did at 15 cents on the dollar, and restructure it. Under the deal Morgan struck with the Honduran government, Morgan's agents would physically occupy Honduran customs offices and shortstop all tax receipts to collect the debt. This incensed Zamore. Over the years, he had worked out a web of favorable tax-free deals with the Honduran government. Now Morgan was promising a banana tax so heavy at a penny a pound that Cuyamel fruit would soon go out of business. Going to Washington to protest this new arrangement, Zamore had a meeting with Knox. The meeting did not go well. Knox lectured Zamore with self-righteous zeal, insisting that Zamore do his part to help the fine bankers at J.P. Morgan make money for the good of the country. Zamore left furious, and Knox was worried enough about his reaction that he ordered a Secret Service detail to follow him. Zamore saw one simple solution to the problem: overthrow the government of Honduras that had cut the deal with Morgan. Conveniently, a deposed former president of Honduras, Manuel Bonilla, was living penniless in New Orleans, a few blocks from Zamore's mansion. Easily avoiding Secret Service surveillance, Zamore furtively recruited mercenaries to acquire arms, get a ship, and smuggle Bonilla back into Honduras. Meanwhile, he made sure the Honduras press railed against the Morgan plan, emphasizing how it would subvert Honduran sovereignty. The Honduran people, already suspicious of the arrangement, were soon roused to revolutionary fervor. The invasion worked. Bonilla returned in triumph. The president of Honduras resigned, and Bonilla was elected in a landslide. He rewarded Zamore with a 25-year tax-free concession, a $500,000 loan, and a gift of 24,700 acres of excellent plantation land on the north coast. Although the Honduran debt would mostly go unpaid, Zamore had achieved a remarkable personal victory. He had outmaneuvered Knox, successfully defied the U.S. government, poked J.P. Morgan in the eye, and ended up a much wealthier man. In engineering the invasion, he had covered his tracks so well that contemporary investigations into the scheme were never able to connect him to it or prove he broke any laws. But he had also intentionally overthrown a government to achieve his own financial ends. Under the presidency of Andrew Preston, United Fruit had grown to be the largest fruit and sugar company in the world. But Zamore's Cuyamel fruit had also grown and was now powerful enough to engage it in debilitating price wars. In 1930, United Fruit solved the problem by buying Cuyamel fruit, paying Zamore $31 million in United Fruit stock and giving him a seat on the board. But the Great Depression hit United Fruit hard. After Preston's death in 1924, the company had become bloated, lazy, and mismanaged. Over the next few years, Zamore watched United Fruit stock decline by over 90%, shrinking his stake to $2 million. He tried to offer the board advice, but was rudely rebuffed. At that point, the board was dominated by members of the Protestant elite of Boston, many, though not all, of whom were ugly anti-Semites. They did not like the Jewish immigrant they had been forced to admit to the board as part of the Cuyamel deal. In a fateful meeting in 1933, Zamore tried once again to persuade the board to consider his ideas for saving the company. The chairman, an effete Boston Brahmin named Daniel Gould Wing, listened to Zamore's heavy Shettle accent with open disdain, and then, to the chuckles of other board members, said, "Unfortunately, Mr. Zamore, I can't understand a word you say." Zamore was not a man to be ignored or insulted. He had come to that particular meeting with a weapon of mass destruction, a bag full of proxies from other United Fruit shareholders that gave him majority control of the company and the authority to act as he saw fit. He left the room, fetched the bag, came back in, and flung it on the table, saying, "You're fired. Can you understand that, Mr. Chairman?" He turned to the board and said, "You've been fucking up this business long enough. I'm going to straighten it out." After ousting the chairman, president, and most of the board, Zumore took over the gigantic bumbling company, roused it from its stupor, and swiftly returned it to profitability. This dramatic move caused the New York Times to call Zumore the fish that swallowed the whale. With full control of United Fruit, Zumore continued to play a heavy hand in Honduran politics until he retreated from business in 1954 to pursue philanthropy full-time. In the later part of his life, perhaps to make up for his earlier questionable dealings, Zumore donated lavishly to Central American causes, schools, and philanthropic ventures. He played a significant role in the founding of Israel. He endowed a female professorship at Harvard, which led to the appointment of the first woman full professor at that university. And he financed the progressive magazine, The Nation. Zumore was a remarkably brilliant, complex, and contradictory man. But colorful as their history was, it must be said, Preston, Zumore, and the fruit companies left a dark colonialist legacy that has hung like a miasma over Honduras ever since. The fruit company's effect on Honduras's development was deeply pernicious. Though Honduras did eventually emerge from under their yoke, this legacy of instability and corporate bullying lives on in political dysfunction, underdeveloped national institutions, and cozy relationships among powerful families, business interests, government, and the military. This weakness magnified the disastrous effects of Hurricane Mitch. The country fell prey to narco traffickers. Effective anti-drug policies and raids in Colombia in the 1990s pushed much of the drug trade from that country into Honduras. Traffickers turned Honduras into the premier drug smuggling transshipment point for cocaine between South America and the United States, and Moquitia was at the heart of it. Crude airstrips were bulldozed out of the jungle and used for nighttime crash landings of drugs flown from Venezuela, the drugs being worth far more than the plane and the occasional death of a pilot. The murder rate soared, while law enforcement and the judicial system crumbled. Violent gangs gained control of swaths of major cities, engaging in extortion and protection rackets, and creating no-go zones for the military and police, except when the police themselves were involved in the activities, which was not uncommon. The unremitting gang violence caused thousands of desperate Honduran families to send their children northward, often alone, in search of safety in the United States. There was no way Elkins could get permits or mount an expedition in this environment. The country looked hopeless. He gave up on the search for the White City, apparently for good. He told me then, "I've had enough. I'm done. Maybe this will be one mystery I can't solve." Chapter 8. Lasers in the Jungle. After giving up on the White City, Elkins turned his attention to the second item on Steve Morgan's list of mysteries, the loot of Lima. He hoped, among other things, that the cutting-edge technology he had learned about in the search for the White City might also be applicable to a hunt for buried treasure. That search into which he drew me would consume the next 10 years of his life. Also known as the Cocos Island treasure, the loot of Lima was an alleged fortune in gold and gems, estimated to be worth around $1 billion. That is believed to have been spirited out of Lima, Peru, in 1821, during the Peruvian War of Independence. The city of Lima was under siege, and the Spanish viceroy reportedly wanted to keep the city's vast treasure out of the hands of the revolutionaries should the city fall to the rebels. The revolutionaries had blockaded the harbor, but were allowing non-combatant foreign ships free passage. The viceroy secretly entrusted the treasure to a British ship captained by an Englishman he knew well. Just in case, he placed on board a contingent of Spanish soldiers and priests to guard the treasure. The plan was for the ship to sail past the blockade and then either bring the treasure back